What I did was I sent out emails to my key people. And these were the people I decided I was going to rely upon to first know about the divorce and then help me through it. And I explained my marriage wasn't working out, but here's what I need from you. I need you to support me and sometimes listen to my nonsensical rantings and get me back on course. And here's what I don't need from you. I don't need you to tell me how bad my ex-wife was or is. And I don't need you to tell me all the mistakes I made along the way. They all told me afterwards it made it so much easier to get on the phone with me because they knew here's what he needs. And this is, as long as I provide this, he's going to be in good shape.
What's up, everybody? It's Charlie Hone, the host of Author Hour, where I interview authors about their new books. And today is a super valuable episode. The book is Moving On, and the author is David Glass. And David has worked both as a therapist and a divorce attorney in a career spanning more than two decades. And what we talk about in this episode is the year after divorce. How do you move on with your life? So once the papers are signed and all the legal issues are settled, a lot of divorced individuals really struggle with this insecurity about what comes next in their life. But David really believes and has seen that divorce can be your second chance at happiness. And this episode is really going to help you get on the path to a more fulfilling future. David shares his experiences both from his career as a family law attorney with a PhD in psychology, but also his personal experiences with his own divorce. And he's going to walk you through exactly how to rebuild your life, including finding a new home, redesigning your family and your social life, re-entering the dating scene, and strengthening your social support. So even though a divorce is really challenging, it is also an opportunity. And in this episode, you'll take your first step to leaving your past behind and starting your new life. And now, here's our conversation with David Glass.
I guess the moment would be was when I was finally deciding to get divorced myself about a decade ago. I had been married for almost 15 years, but the last two or three years had not been the best years of the marriage. Me and my ex-wife didn't argue in front of the kids, and we didn't fight about things, but we weren't very close. We had lost intimacy, and neither of us was completely happy. But I was still reticent about starting off on my divorce because I was mainly concerned about what's going to happen next. And that's even with a background. I have a PhD in clinical psychology and practice as a therapist. And by then, I'd been practicing as a divorce attorney for over 15 years. And I still had these issues that were holding me back from moving on to the rest of my life. And so I talked to a bunch of friends, both divorced and married and single, and tried to figure out what would come next and how could I maximize it. And so I figured my way through the process. Divorce was relatively easy for me. The year after divorce was much more difficult. And just keeping those ideas in mind for the last 10 years, I turned around how I started counseling my own divorce clients, trying to get them to focus on what comes next rather than continuing to focus on the unsuccessful relationship in their background.
So you said the year after divorce was much more difficult. What made it so difficult? Was it just the nature that you'd been through a trauma or what was it?
For me, there weren't legal proceedings. My ex-wife and I were both smart and level-headed, and we worked out a deal right away. So there wasn't a lot of fighting about it. But still, getting divorced is a psychological injury. It's an injury to your ego. You tried something. You picked someone. You tried a marriage and developed a family, but ultimately, it didn't work out. So it's admitting failure to everyone. Everyone's going to know that you failed in this thing. It turns out that, you know, with 50% of the population getting divorced, it's not an unusual failure. But for each person going through it, it's very personal. And for me, up to that point, I had gotten into the college I wanted to get into. I got into the graduate school I wanted to get into. I got the jobs I wanted. I would interview, I'd get the jobs. I'd never been fired from a job. And so luckily for me, this was the first failure that I had to experience. And so that was all new for me. And that's what was somewhat paralyzing at the beginning.
Would you say that's really common with your clients as well, is what you're describing, that it is this psychological injury, it is this admission of failing at something many, many of us really aspire to have?
Absolutely. That's the, and most of my clients are, you know, doctors, lawyers, dentists, teachers, principals, sort of regular everyday people. And most of them have not had major problems in their lives. Some of them may have been through a bankruptcy, or some of them may have had a parent or a family member deal with an illness. But those were much more external things that you can control or try and modify. But getting your own divorce is trying to, if you do it the right way, is trying to figure out what you did wrong in addition to what your soon-to-be ex-spouse did wrong, and then converting that into how am I going to avoid having this happen again in the future. But that feeling that, you know, this didn't work out. I picked this person. We had a big fancy wedding. We'd lived together. We've held ourselves out as a family for all these years. And now I have to admit to everyone, it really wasn't working out, and now I've got to figure out the rest of my life.
Wow. So I want to dig in a little bit more on what that year after was really like, because I'd imagine a number of people listening to this right now are either in the thick of it or they're about to be, and they want to know what did that really look like for you?
Right. So the year after divorce is now, you used to live all together in one home, and whether you were happy or mildly happy or upset, it was still the stasis. It was what you were used to. And anytime human beings move from someplace where they were to something new, it's hard to make that change. And so the first thing I was dealing with was living on my own. I had two daughters who were 8 and 10, and we had a 50-50 custody arrangement. So 50% of the week, they were with me and I could focus on them. But 50% of the time I was alone in an apartment. And that was a brand new experience for me after having been married for a relatively long time and after having dated and lived together with my ex-spouse. And so just dealing with being alone in a home space was a brand new experience for me. And so at first, what I did was I made all sorts of social arrangements. I contacted all my friends and lined them up for the nights that I didn't have the girls. And, you know, one night we would go out and play tennis, and another night we would go for a sunset hike, and other nights we would go out for drinks. But it was scheduling myself so that I wasn't at home sitting in an empty apartment and wondering, you know, how I got to that period.
Mm-hmm. And I'd imagine that helped a lot, right?
Oh, absolutely. Keeping myself busy during my downtime when I didn't have the kids prevented me from ruminating about things that I really couldn't change anyway. And keeping busy and being social also opened me up to all the great things that go on in the world that you can forget about if you're in a troubled marriage. So the last couple of years of anyone's troubled marriage, you're probably not taking care of your fitness as much as you could. You're probably not seeing your friends as often as you would like. You're probably not doing as many enjoyable activities. And so when you have this free time, if you look at it not as what I've lost, I don't have my kids half the time, or I don't have a intact nuclear family. If you look at it instead of now I have an opportunity, what do I want to do with this time? That's the shift in perspective that allows you to start moving forward.
That's great. So let's get into your book now and what moving on really covers. So you begin the book with assessing where you are now. Why is it so important with the assessment?
So the assessment is just making sure people are ready to move on. Until you make the decision, I am getting divorced, I'm going to divide the assets, we're going to figure out support, we're going to figure out where the kids live, and then you put enough of that stuff on paper, you're in no position to move on. Again, while you're going through the divorce, it takes up a lot of your time and a lot of your energy, and there's no way around it. But once you're at the very end of that process, then you can start opening up and figuring out what comes next. So the assessment becomes key, because if you're not divorced yet or you're just starting the process, then maybe the book's a little bit early. You can start leafing through it to think about it, but you're not going to be able to invest enough energy and your emotions and your intellect into figuring out what comes next.
Got it. Okay. So once they've gotten to that point, they've assessed where they are, this book is definitely for them. The next step in the process is telling family and friends, right?
Right. And so, and that comes, it's sort of an overlap with what came before, but telling other people that you're getting divorced can be a paralyzing experience. I'm going to call up my parents and admit that maybe my parents were right. This person was never right for me in the first place. Or maybe my friends who never really liked my now ex-spouse were right. And so it's admitting to a lot of people that you were wrong. But if you turn that into an opportunity to say, this is what I'm doing, and this is the help I need from you, I think it makes it a better experience. So what I did was I sent out emails to my key people, my both of my parents, my college roommate and best friend, a local close friend, and my sister. And these were the people I decided I was going to rely upon to first know about the divorce and then help me through it. And I explained, my marriage wasn't working out. Maybe you saw it, maybe you didn't, but here's what I need from you. I need you to support me and sometimes listen to my nonsensical rantings and get me back on course. And here's what I don't need from you. I don't need you to tell me how bad my ex-wife was or is. And I don't need you to tell me all the mistakes I made along the way. And by laying out for these key people who are closest to me what I needed from them, they all told me afterwards it made it so much easier to get on the phone with me because they knew here's what he needs. And this is as long as I provide this, he's going to be in good shape. And so I use this announcement that I'm getting divorced to shape how people were going to interact with me over the next year.
Wow. That's super smart. Holy cow. Did you really see that immediately, like how effective that was?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I saw it first from my parents because most parents, when their child's getting divorced, they take that very personally. And of course they love their child and they want to support them. But a lot of parents turn to the negativity. Oh, I never liked him or her, or they never worked hard as you and you could have done better. And they just fall into that trap. And hearing that doesn't help anything. If you're trying to move forward, hearing about what went on wrong in the past doesn't really help you, and hearing from your parents definitely doesn't help. But by them hearing, them just being refocused, all right, you're right. We're not talking about the ex. We're talking about what comes next and what we can help with. And so, you know, I turned to my parents for some financial help because all our assets were being divided and were tied up, and I didn't have as much cash as I needed. And I turned to my friends for social life and for just talking things through. But I let them know, this is what I'm going to be asking for, and this is what I want in return, which sounds very controlling, but I think it helped them be the best friends and family members and close confidants they could be.
Did you deal with any pushback, any commentary from family or friends that was harsh, even in spite of that email?
No, they all played along with the playbook exactly as I asked them to, and it was a pleasure to deal with them. I did have problems with one of my friends farther along. Once I was through the process, and after a year, I started dating, and I became relatively close with my wife, you know, then a girlfriend, became a fiance, became a wife, relatively quickly. And that friend was telling me, you're moving too fast and don't jump into something right away and maybe date a while. And I just didn't want to hear that negativity. And so I had to basically exclude myself from this person for a while.
How do you balance that out, though? Because on the surface, that does sound like reasonable advice.
Oh, absolutely. It was reasonable advice. I just didn't want to hear it from this individual person right then. And so I tried to redirect this person and say, listen, I don't really want to talk about that. I'm very happy with this person. I really want to focus on it. I appreciate what you told me, but I don't want to talk about it anymore. And so it's hearing it, but then not getting stuck constantly talking about it.
You seem to have a really healthy set of personal boundaries for people who maybe are getting divorced, who aren't used to speaking to others with that kind of directness. What do you suggest for them?
It's just practice. It's not being so careful about what you say. if you're talking to your closest circle of friends there and family members, if you say something that's wrong, if you say something obnoxious, if you say something even aggressive, they're going to forgive you and they're going to realize what you're going through. So it's first letting go of all those inhibitions that you're not talking to your boss or your subordinate at work or a client. That's a totally different way of talking. You've got to figure out how to be a lot more free and just let everything out with these close couple of people. And in time, when you practice that, it becomes very easy. Once you let go of all those filters and you're just talking, it actually relieves a lot of anxiety and worry about things.
100% agreed. That's great. Now, let's talk about the finances, right? Because this is a constant stressor for many people who go through divorce. They feel it's unfair to them that they're maybe paying a lot in child support and having to go into debt and having their wages garnished and all this stuff. So how do you design your financial strategy to help you move on?
Right. So it's convincing people that while it may seem unfair or it may seem like you're paying too much or on the other hand that you're receiving too little, all the state legislatures, when they've set up these support rules and their formulas for figuring it out, try to get to something that's as fair as possible. And so recognizing that you're not going to change the state legislature and you're not going to change the law on how support is calculated. And so complaining about something that you have absolutely no control over just isn't productive. And so then it's turning from what's behind you. You have a support order that you have to pay, is now figuring out what is your personal budget going to be on a monthly basis so that you have enough money to pay the support and still meet your own living expenses. Or on the other side, that with this influx of support, plus whatever you can make on your own, you can afford your living expenses. And it's basic budgeting, getting a one-page budget and figuring out what you pay in rent or mortgage and what you pay for electric and gas and your cell phone and your cable bill and putting every possible expense down and then adding it all up. I've got a $10,000 a month budget and I've got $3,000 coming in. That means I have to make $7,000 a month. And if you can't make $7,000 a month, then you've got to change your budget or you've got to get a different job. And so by putting everything down on paper, it forces you to think about what you're spending money on. I looked and I was spending $187 on a cable bill and I didn't watch TV and my girls were streaming everything. And I just realized, why am I paying for cable that no one's watching? And I switched to just an internet only thing that was like $49. And so that saved me some money. But if you look at each category, you can realize I'm spending $50 a week going to Starbucks and I could brew my own coffee and I could save a lot of money over the course of this next year, not going to Starbucks. But until you see it down on a piece of paper and you see it all added up, it's hard to imagine even where your money's going.
It's absolutely true. I mean, you can imagine where your money's going, but you're not very good at it unless you actually look at it and review it. Not to get too much into the financial portion, because you cover that in your book, but it really is shocking that you think you're on point with being good with money. A friend of mine looked at her finances recently and realized she was spending several thousand dollars per month going out to eat, and she thought she was doing maybe $1,000 a month. And
right.
I mean, I've had the same issue with cell phone bills and all this stuff. So that's great that you include that. Now, let's move on to some of the more complex things, the things that carry just as much emotional weight when you're changing your life, starting with choosing a new place to live. Walk me through this.
Right. So most people, when they get divorced, if you have two incomes and you're contributing to the mortgage on a house, now neither party can afford the house. And so in most cases, the marital residence where everyone lived together gets sold, and now you've got to figure out where you're going to live. And so with that opportunity, I advise people during the first year to rent something until they figure out exactly what's going on. You've got too much up in the air during that first year post-divorce. You're getting used to schedules with kids and paying support and figuring out your budget. And having to pick a new house, apply for a mortgage, figure out if you can afford it, I think is something that you shouldn't do in the first year. But either way, whether you're going to buy a new house or you're just going to rent for a year to figure out where you want to be, eventually you have to figure out, how close do I want to live to my ex-spouse? If you're going to move somewhere very far, you're adding all sorts of commute time if you have kids and exchanging the kids. And or you figure out, I want to be close to the kids' school, or I want to be close to my own work. And you have to figure out what your most important things are and list them out, and then come up with the neighborhood you want to live in. And so you don't have to live in the same place, the same exact neighborhood, or the same part of the city or town where you used to live. But it makes sense to look at what schools your kids are going to, where you have to go to work, where your friends are, and where your favorite activities are, and then pick somewhere in the middle of all those.
That's phenomenal advice to rent and not get caught up in overspending potentially or overcommitting to a place that you either can't afford or may not end up in long term. Do you find that a lot of your clients have difficulty taking that step back in their life, that maybe downgrading?
Absolutely. A lot of people do. And I had some concerns about it myself. I was in a relatively big house with a big yard and a pool, and I decided to go into an apartment, a three-bedroom apartment that had a shared pool for the apartment complex, but I didn't have a yard. I didn't have my own pool. And a lot of people are, again, it's an ego thing. Going from owning a house to being in an apartment is a step back.
Right. I mean, some people listening to that might think, a three-bedroom apartment, wow, that's really great. But it's all relative. It's all subjective. So if your previous living situation was much bigger or grander or opulent or anything, it felt like a major downgrade.
Right. And going from owning to renting is some sort of downgrade. But for me, and a lot of people use the excuse, I don't want to move the kids out of the only home they've known, or the kids won't like it, or the kids won't be able to adapt. And I can tell any person who's thinking about that out there, it's absolutely not true. Your kids are much more flexible and more resilient than you are, and definitely more resilient and flexible than you think they are. My girls were 8 and 10, and I was worried about going from a house into an apartment and what they would think. And the surprise was, when we moved into this apartment, they were so thrilled that they were allowed to take the elevator up to the roof of the building and ride their scooters, their Razor scooters, around on the roof without me being there, because it was a building with a doorman and it was safe and they could go up and down the elevator by themselves. They were so thrilled with that, they started bringing friends to the house just to show them that they were allowed to go up and down the elevator. And I would have never imagined that. I thought they'd be upset that they were now sharing a bedroom instead of having their own bedrooms. And none of that mattered, because children just want to be with their parents. They want time with their parents, and they want to be able to keep going to school and keep doing their activities. So where they live is way down on the list of things that are important to kids.
Did you give any consideration into your new living space? How fun is this going to be for my kids? Like, will this be a magnet for them to want to come visit me?
It was. And so I made sure I had a building. I'm in Southern California, and so everyone has access to a pool, or swimming becomes a, you know, 3/4 of the year activity. So I made sure there was a pool. I made sure there was an outdoor area that they could shoot basketball or hit a tennis ball against the wall. And so I made sure those things were there. But again, I rented because I did not want to be locked into anything. And I'll go one step further. I rented a fully furnished apartment, because I didn't want any of the furniture from my old home. I was thinking ahead. I'm thinking, I'm a man. If I get my own apartment, I'm going to set it up as a bachelor pad. And then I'm eventually going to meet some woman, and she's not going to want my black leather couch, and she's not going to want all the decorations that I thought were great, but most women wouldn't like in their home. And it's exactly the way it worked out. A year later, I met a wonderful woman. We ended up buying a house together. We furnished it with her furniture and her designs. And the fact that I didn't come with any furniture or any decorations was made it very easy.
Now, let's talk about the new dynamic you've created, right? You've created a new dynamic for your family life. And this, I know, is a lot of the concern for that holds people back from getting a divorce, is what is it going to do to our family? will this permanently damage our kids? So talk to me about building or rebuilding this new family life.
Yeah, well, first of all, the psych literature, they've done longitudinal studies following kids of divorce over 5, 10, 15, and now even 20 years. And the research clearly shows that children of divorce are not any worse off than children in intact families. And in fact, they're better off than children who are in intact families where the parents argue a lot. Yeah, that children just need their parents to be friendly. They don't need their parents to be friends. They don't need their parents to be married. But if their parents are friendly and can get along and don't argue about them or talk about them in a negative sense, kids very quickly learn, I'm with dad this part of the week, I'm with mom this part of the week, and they very quickly fall into line, even if mom and dad have very different ways of parenting.
Wait, so this is really surprising to me because everything I've heard has been about how hard it is on the kids, and it's permanently like this thing that sticks with them. And I've heard friends of mine growing up, yeah, my parents got divorced, and you know, it's always kind of stuck with me.
The problem is that most people don't get divorced in a smart or a emotionally adept way. And so if you have two divorced parents and they're constantly complaining about each other, your dad doesn't send the support on time, he doesn't send me enough money, your mom is crazy, she's too caught up in trying to force you into therapy. If they're talking badly about the other parent, that definitely leads to long-term problems for kids who see the two people who created them and created a family can't even get along when they're living apart. That's where all the negativity for kids comes from. If their parents can cooperate on a minimal basis, it opens up the opportunity really for them to see their parents hopefully find a new mate that they get along with. I remember when I was getting divorced, I was thinking about what example am I showing my two daughters? They're seeing two people who run a marriage like a business. We made money and we accumulated wealth and we went to all the right activities and we went out to dinner, but they never saw their parents close and intimate and they didn't see us doing things together. And I didn't want my daughters to have that model as that's what a marriage is. It's sort of okay. It's sort of middle of the road. It's not bad, but it's not great either. And in my case, both me and my ex-spouse within 2 years found new mates who better matched who we were and how we like to live our lives. And my daughters, who are now in college and a high school senior, talk about it's great to see both you and mom happy. You both have happy homes. It's a pleasure to go in between your two homes because wherever we are, everyone's happy.
Hmm, that's beautiful. And you know, this reminds me of another interview I did with Philip McKernan. He did a book called One Last Talk. And in that book, he shares how this woman confessed that she'd always felt guilty about the divorce that she went through. She was ashamed. She felt like she'd failed, as you'd mentioned at the beginning, and worried that it had hurt her kids. And then after she gave that talk, her daughter told her, oh my gosh, you couldn't be more wrong. I viewed that time as, wow, mom is really stepping up in taking charge of her life and what she wants and pursuing what is most important to her. It gave me more of a model of what it's like to assertively retake control of your life. And it was this really positive example for their family. So I think that's exactly what you're saying, is that kids are resilient and it can be a positive thing depending on how you handle it.
Right. And it's not even so much what you tell your children. And you should tell your children the right things, that this divorce isn't your fault and we're going to try and keep as much steady and the same for you. Same school, same friends, same activities. The only thing different is that mom and dad aren't going to be living in the same home. That's all important to tell them. But the most important is showing them by example. I have a quote in the book from Robert Fulghum, the author, that says, don't be worried that your children aren't listening to you. Be worried that they're watching everything you do. And so by showing them how to live an effective and happy life, that's the best thing you can do for your children. They're going to figure out their own way. But if they've had a model of what a good relationship looks like and how people can argue and get over it and how people can work together and build a new family, that's the best thing you can possibly teach your kids.
Absolutely. Speaking of quotes, you have a lot of great quotes in the book. One that made me laugh is, money is not the most important thing. Love is. Fortunately, I love money.
Right. And it's Jackie Mason, who has a million one-liners. But that was, and doing the research for the book, I tried to find a quote for each chapter. And I was so thrilled to find that one.
Yeah. So we covered a bit at the beginning how you redesigned your social life. You filled up your calendar and reached out to friends. And is there anything else that we need to know about redesigning your social life in order to properly move on?
Yeah, it's actually a step before you even think about your social life is redesigning your emotional life. I strongly advise all of my clients to get into therapy. If they haven't been with a therapist, they need to find one. If they've known one, they need to reconnect. And if they're in therapy, they need to change the focus of the therapy. And I think the focus for people in that year after divorce should be on, what did I do wrong in this prior relationship? It's very easy to make the list of what your ex-spouse did wrong. Everyone can do that. Everyone can talk about it for hours, but it doesn't get you anywhere other than determining you weren't right for each other. But figuring out what you contributed, what did I do that made him or her then do this in return? And how did I contribute to any sort of dysfunction in the family? Or how did my way of being not make me a good spouse? That's the most valuable thing you can do for yourself before you figure out who your friends are, before you figure out who you want to date, and before you ultimately find your next mate. Because if you don't do that work, the odds are you're going to end
up picking. You're going to repeat it.
You're going to find the same exact person. And so if first marriages, the divorce rate is just over 50%, the rate for second marriages getting divorced is actually 65%, and third marriages are 75% in the United States. And that statistic shows you that people get out of one relationship, they pick the same person or a similar person, they don't change anything different about themselves, and guess what? They have the same exact bad result.
Yeah. That's really wise. In taking a cue from how you communicated with your family and friends when you announced the divorce, do you think it's a good idea to tell your therapist, keep me on the track of only talking about what I did wrong so I can figure that out, and don't allow me to trash talk my ex?
Absolutely. And most good therapists will do that anyway, but just reminding them up front. And you can have a session or two, an hour and a half, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours of talking about what went wrong. But then you very quickly got to transition into focusing on yourself. Again, psychotherapy is about what you feel, how you behave, and figuring out what you want to change to fix things that aren't working in your life. And talking about a third party who's in your past doesn't help you do any of those things that you're supposed to be doing.
David, I'd imagine some people are a bit resistant to therapy for any number of reasons. It could even just be as basic as it costs money and I'm kind of financially strapped right now. What are your recommendations for people who are maybe on the fence or resistant to the idea of getting counseling?
Right. And so the first thing I tell them is that although there were all sorts of social norms and reasons not to go into therapy, it's going to be a black mark against your character, it means you're weak, it means you have a problem, most of those things have fallen away. And again, I'm in Southern California, and it's hard to, you know, to wave a stick and not point it at someone who has been in therapy or is currently in therapy. Different parts of the country, it's not as used, but the bottom line is that it's worth any money that you're going to put into therapy. And most health insurance provide for 30 sessions that are covered with the therapist that they recommend you to. And most therapists...
If you're going through divorce?
Yeah, for divorce or any reason. Anytime you go therapy through your health insurance, most of them provide 30 sessions, which will get you through the, you know, once a week for... you know, 3/5 of the year, which is a good long time
to have
it covered. Yeah. And even if you don't have it or you don't want to go with the insurance person, it's a very important budgetary consideration. Find a therapist that you can afford. You don't need the most expensive, but you just need someone who's experienced and who you enjoy sitting in a room talking with, because this is the person who all they're listening to is you during that 1 hour you're with them, and their only job is to try and help you. And that's what makes the therapist unique and different from your family members or friends or best friend or colleagues. They have a million things going on in their life, and while they're listening to you, they can't give you 100% of their attention. This therapist not only can give you 100% of their attention, they're also trained in techniques and skills and ways to improve your life. And if you're talking and listening to them, that back and forth, you're going to feel better after the 12 weeks that you go, or the 15 weeks, or even the 30 weeks that you go.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in total agreement there. And I'll just quickly double down on what you said. You really just need someone experienced who you enjoy talking with. I see a lot of the sticking point with people choosing a therapist is how do I find a good therapist? And the data, the studies have shown, like, it really just needs to be somebody who's good at what they do, good enough at what they do, and you, like you said, feel a good emotional connection with them. Otherwise, if they're the greatest therapist in town, but you don't like them, you're still going to get bad results.
Right. And the same studies also show that the amount of time someone has practiced as a therapist is not correlated with being any better at helping any individual patient or client. It's so you don't need the most experienced. You don't need the most expensive. You don't need the person that everyone talks about and who can't give you an appointment for another 6 weeks. You need someone who you can get into on a weekly basis, have that hour carved aside where you're just focusing on yourself. And most therapists who have gone through, you know, either a master's or a PhD program are capable of helping you with that issue.
Hmm. And that's so valuable to know about the health insurance. Most health insurance providers can give you 30 free sessions of therapy, regardless of the reason, basically. So how did you find out, or did you call your health insurance provider? Did you look it up on their site? How did you go about fulfilling those?
Yeah, I had already had...
I know I'm getting tactical, but...
No, it's all right. I had already had this therapist for years before when I had some issues with my career. I'd gone to see a therapist to try and figure out, again, what my piece in was. And then I hadn't seen her for a while, so I went right back to her. But when I originally found her, I got on the website for the health insurance program. I put in my zip code and gave a 5-mile radius, and it gave me 30 names. And then I clicked through the names and looked at their backgrounds. And for me, I didn't want anyone to be old style Freudian, and I didn't want like a new age therapist. I wanted what's called a cognitive behavioral therapist, someone who helps you reset your thinking to then be able to reset your behavior. But whatever you're looking for, they have it all on the website. And I picked two. I went to talk to both of those people, and I preferred one over the other, and I jumped in. And so it seems like a big step to find a therapist, but if you just take the little steps along the way and you take that first step, I'm going to go to the website and look up the names. And then the next step is where, and the next step is what kind of therapist. And then you just interview two of them. You're going to find someone that you feel that you can work with.
Awesome. Awesome advice. Now, let's talk about the dating scene, I guess. How do you break back into the dating world after being married for so many years? What is this transition like?
Right, and that's actually one of the harder transitions. It's comparatively, it's easier to figure out where you want to live and how you want to run your budget, or even who you want your friends to be. But then that dating, especially if you've been out of the dating scene for a number of years, and most people getting divorced have, everything has changed. And for me, you know, when I met my ex-wife, we were both in law school. And that was it. There were a bunch of law students around, and you met people. It was easy to meet people because there were 200 people in the class. But there wasn't any online dating services, and there wasn't Facebook, there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't any of that stuff when I went through it the first time. And the second time, and I was 23 years old at the time when I went through my divorce, and I'm post-divorce, I was 40 or 41 years old. And so it's hard to get back into it. And basically the way I did it was I got three friends with different styles, and I called them informally my three wise men. One was a guy who had been divorced and vowed he was never going to get married again. And one was someone who was happily married, and one was a guy who had never been married. And I just asked them, how do you date and how do you meet people and what should I say to someone and what should I propose doing? And I would ask all three of them. I'd try to come to a consensus, and that's how I acted. And, you know, two out of the three said, don't even do online dating. You don't want to get caught up in that quagmire. And so I didn't. And so I really don't know a lot about online dating other than I didn't do it. But they always had all sorts of advice. And the funny thing is that when I met the right person, when I met the woman I'm married to, after we had dated for a while, I told them, I've got these three guys. I call them the three wise men. And, you know, they say this, that, and the other thing. She's wonderful because she's very straightforward. And I've learned to be a lot more straightforward from her. She said, you don't need to listen to them anymore, that you're doing everything fine. You don't need their advice. You and I know how to communicate. Let's just live. And then I jettisoned the three wise men, and it just figured it out from there. But at the beginning, they were very helpful.
That's awesome. You got some good friends. And that is a very rational, reasonable, methodical approach to reentering the dating scene. I'd imagine a lot of people don't take such a methodical approach as you, just because they're freaked out. And they've just been through the same. They got a lot of negative chatter in their head. So, I mean, it goes to show like the importance of you talking to your friends, relying on their input and sort of following the blueprint that they lay out for you. That seems to help. And also the counseling you've laid the groundwork there to talk through most of your issues and to bring yourself out as a better potential mate. Is there anything else?
Absolutely. And my father at my wedding gave a brief speech, and he said, you know, the important thing is not only to find the right spouse, but also to be the right spouse. And that goes right back to the issue of working on yourself so that you can be the best person you can be. But with dating, it's just trying to find out a way to do anything. And all these solutions that I'm giving people in the book, whether it's financial or emotional or social or dating, they're all very practical. They're all almost, you know, pen and paper, figuring out a strategy and taking things step by step. Because I just believe that's the way to work through any issue that you have, is by what's called creative problem solving. Number one, you identify that you have a problem. Number two, you then brainstorm to try and figure out as many possible solutions to that problem as possible. And you don't edit yourself during that process. You don't say, oh, that's stupid, or that would never work, or that doesn't make sense for me. You just get them all down on paper, and you generate 12 to 15 possible solutions for a problem. Then you look at those 12 to 15 possible solutions, and you ask yourself, if I did that, what would happen next? And by following that what would happen next progression, out of those 12 or 15, one or two are going to come to the top as the best solutions. And so by forcing yourself to get didactic and putting things on paper and slowing your thinking down, it naturally leads you into the best solutions. And the other thing to remember is that creative problem solving isn't an all or nothing thing. If you narrow it down to one or two things and you try something and it doesn't work, it's not a tragedy. You just regroup, come back, try a different alternative, and probably the second thing will work. So it's not being afraid to have small failures along the way. That's part of the problem-solving solution.
That's awesome. David, I say this completely sincerely. I really respect the way that you think about improving your life. It's really measured, and I think that might even be could be your next book, is how to think like that. So it's really, really good. So a couple more areas I want to cover, which is, I mean, you're in the dating scene and let's say it goes well. You're now in a relationship. What do we need to know about this, this part of the process?
Right. Yeah. So the next part of the process is basically, if you have children, is the question is, when am I going to introduce my new girlfriend, boyfriend, lover, potential mate, whatever you're calling them, to my children? And I set a hard and fast rule that you should be dating at least 6 months and hopefully closer to a year before you ever introduce someone new to your children.
Why is that?
I set up these rules just to make sure that you're being as conservative as possible. Because if you meet a new person, you introduce them to your kids, and then it doesn't work out. Then you meet a new person and introduce them to your kids, and it doesn't work out. Your kids are seeing that people are either throwaways, that you can have multiple relationships and never have them work out, and that's fine, which I don't believe is a good answer. Some people will tell you it is, but I don't believe that. And the other thing is, it takes investment for children to start accepting a new mate for their parents. And I think it's unfair to force kids to get acclimated to develop a relationship with a person until you're absolutely sure this is the right person for me and for my family. And so I set it at 6 months to a year, and that's what I did. I dated during my non-kid nights, and I told my now wife at that time, we're going to have our own relationship, and I don't want the kids weighing us down, and we want to make sure that we're on the right track before you ever start meeting the kids. And then when we're both ready, then we're going to introduce you to the kids. And it worked out for me, for my clients who have also done the same thing. Having a hard and fast rule, it just takes it out of your mind of trying to decide, is the timing right or not? Don't worry about making that decision. Just go with 6 months to a year. Date without having your kids meet your new potential mate.
That's phenomenal advice. And as someone who's witnessed that among peers, the frustration of parents dating new people, maybe in getting introduced a little too quickly in that sensitive period where it may not work out, that can create so much frustration and anger and resentment. And just avoiding that is huge for the family. So we've covered a lot. The final question I really have is blending the families together when you get remarried, or if you decide to get remarried. What are the things people need to know in this new chapter of their life?
If you're getting remarried and you're remarrying someone without children, your main focus for the period of time where you're engaged but not yet married is figuring out how you're all going to live together as a family. And that period, I think the emphasis has to be on your new mate. And in a weird way, you have to put your new spouse a little bit ahead of your children, which is hard for a lot of parents to hear. But if they think about it, you're choosing a new person, you're starting a new life with this person, you're going to incorporate your children into your life. But unless this new partner is a little bit ahead of the kids and their needs come a teeny bit ahead of the whatever the children need, you're never going to have that close relationship that you need to establish a family. And so the example I give people is when I dated for about 8 months, and then I introduced my then girlfriend to my children, and we allowed them to work out everything they had to work out. They started by spending an hour together when we'd all go out bowling, or then we would take a 2-hour hike, and we slowly built up the amount of time that we all spent together. But when my, at that point, she was a fiance, and I bought a house and we were all going to move in together. My fiance and I moved into the house first, and we spent 2 or even 3 weeks living there before my children moved into the house. And the reason I did that is I wanted my children to understand that this was a house that me and my new almost wife were establishing for our family. There wasn't any question that this was my house with my children and I was inviting her in. That this was a new family house, there were new family rules, and they were being invited to join us. And then the next step was having a family meeting and saying, these are the rules for our new house. This is how we're going to live together. We're not going to take food up to our rooms, or we are not going to leave our sneakers by the front door. Whatever your rules are, if you lay them out at the start in a family meeting, everyone knows what the rules are. And there's less resentment when they're told not to do something or how to do something different later.
Well, this has been just tremendously valuable to anybody who's going through this experience now, who potentially might want to follow you and your work or even reach out to you. How would you recommend that they do that?
And so the easiest way to reach me is through the website, www.glassfamilylaw.com. That'll redirect them to my professional page. The book is movingonbook.com, and that will also get them to me either by email or phone. And the only other thing I want to emphasize to people is that divorce really is a second chance for happiness. It's a bad thing that happens in your life, but it opens up so many possibilities for you that I just hope people really take the opportunity to investigate every area of their life and try to maximize their happiness going forward.
Beautifully said. David, the final question I have for you is to give our listeners a challenge. If they're going through this right now, what is one thing from your book that they can do this week that will have a positive impact? You have about 15 seconds. Go.
Right. If they take a piece of paper and divide it into six sections, and the sections are social, financial, housing, children, dating, and emotional, if they list out what their problems are in each one of those boxes, that's the way to get started on problem solving in each of the various areas.
The book is Moving On. David Glass, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks a lot. This was really fun.
Thanks again to David Glass for being on the show. You can buy his book, Moving on Amazon.com. Thanks for tuning into today's show. If you liked what you heard, here's what I want you to do next. Open up the podcast app on your phone or iTunes on your computer and search for Author Hour with Charlie Hone. And then click Ratings and Reviews. Take 10 seconds to rate this show or leave a review. It's a small favor, but it's really the best way to show your support and give me feedback. And if you know someone else who'd love Author Hour, take another 3 seconds to text them a link to this episode. We'll see you next time.